following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought World War II, gave you Martin Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. No matter who you are, no matter what you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
Well, I just heard the words ready when you are, and so this is Norman Lear with all of the above, or could be said the other way, all of the above with, and Paul Hipp is sitting next to me.
Hi, Norman.
And two people I've been working with for the last year or more, who have just scored the biggest victory in the history of big victories on television. And we'll talk all about that. This is Mike Royce and Gloria Calderon-Killett. I think I say Colette wrong. I'm going to find out when she gets here. I think I learned last night and immediately forgot that I had made a mistake. And it's Colette? I'll find out.
You'll find out.
So they're here any minute now, Paul.
So you guys have a lot of, you've some exciting stuff going on with these two.
They are the heroes of heroes.
Well, I've been reading reviews, and as if season one, have we said what it is yet, or are we keeping that as a surprise for the audience?
Yeah, we're keeping that as a total surprise. We're not going to say that until the hour is up.
Well, I will say
it's
this.
It's one day at a time.
And the reviews for season two are unbelievable. They're coming out now, and one after the other is. Did you write them?
I wrote every review, yeah. This is the Latino version of One Day at a Time, an ancient show I did years and years ago. And Gloria and Mike and Gloria, they have made a Latino version of it that is. In at its heart and soul, it's 180 degrees removed from the original.
And brand new.
Because it is of the moment.
Yeah.
And the problems, I don't know, it's as deep as anything I've ever been associated with.
And streaming on Netflix.
And streaming on Netflix. And the door is opening.
Hey, they're
coming in. Wow. I'll be a son of a gun. And they're about to look at them, sit down. Are they cute?
Yeah, right on time. It's amazing.
Yes.
Right on time.
Mike, Gloria, hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Now I want the audience to see if they can, just hearing them, if they know which one is Gloria, which one is Mike.
I'm Gloria.
I'm Mike.
Well, hi.
There you go. If you believe that, go to podcast two. Anyway, it's good to be here. Great to be with you guys. And great, it's within a couple of hours of reading a review the New York Times is.
Wow.
And how about that, Paul?
It's an unbelievable review. I mean, it's just everything you could ask for. Do you have it in front of you? Because the last line of it was just, I mean, the whole review is just great.
I could try to remember.
Beautiful.
I was singing
line.
It to myself.
Yeah, you must. You probably, have you memorized it? But
yeah,
it's a love letter.
Very happy about it.
And that's a popular, from what I understand, that's a very popular publication.
Well.
The New York Times.
The New York Times is it's called the paper of record.
Well, but I will say this. It's the failing New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
The failing New York Times. Our president calls it.
That's where we read. Out of D.C., we read about the failing.
Well, fake news loves us.
That's right. That's right.
So last night at the Arclight Theater, is a huge theater on Sunset Boulevard. Those of you who are listening and may not have been to it or seen it, and it was the first time, I've got a long history in our business, It's the first time I've ever seen a half-hour situation comedy played on a huge screen in a huge theater for a huge audience. It's the first time I've ever seen it. I would never have guessed it would play like a David O. Selznick film or something, like a great film of the past and present. I mean, it was just, there were two episodes that will be, that start on Netflix tomorrow.
Midnight, actually.
No,
midnight
Friday.
Midnight tonight.
Well, right.
We go on Monday, and this is
then it will be available when you hear this.
Yes. Start watching.
What are you
now.
Doing? Why are you still listening? Go watch it.
Go watch one day at a time.
Then come back.
So
and finish. Listening
my association with the show in no way prepared me for these two episodes, which is. I suggest I was not all that involved in them. I don't know. I was as proud as I could be, but I was also occupying a seat as a film lover. I mean, utterly entranced by the cast and by the writing, and I wish I could spend an hour talking about the writing, because the writing was so from the inside. But, I mean, it just felt altogether its own kind of inside-out writing.
That's pretty great.
Well, gosh, I mean.
I guess we have to end Paul, the podcast here.
I can't tell you. I'm sorry. I woke up thinking about being here now and that you weren't there last night. Perhaps you couldn't have come, but I failed to make mention of it.
Yeah, no, I didn't have anything to do. But don't worry about it, because I'm here now. You know what I mean?
Listen, we can't afford you're now audience. We need your Netflix
numbers.
We need
you to watch.
Well, yes. As a member of the audience, I'm curious to know. So season one last year, big success. Critically, people loved it. I hear great stuff. I would meet people, talk about it. Now you're coming up on season two. Okay, so these first two episodes, as Norman mentioned, just so great. As writers, this is a big question, and there might be no short answer, but okay, you've got that first season. Now you're going to pick up the ball. Did you have it in your head where this is going? And then how do you get into that? How do you approach it? How do you get into season two?
You want to do your hot fresh?
Well, now I have to because it sounds
Mike
pornographic.
Mike is a TV veteran as well as Norman. And he likes to be Professor Mike sometimes. And
Professor Mike.
Tell us.
Testify.
When writing a television program.
This is how he talks.
Brilliant!
Yeah, he talks this way in the room too, guys.
Well, next question.
As a scribe.
We have fundamentally two different attitudes, which is my attitude. Are we allowed to swear on this particular? So her attitude is, "Oh my god, I'm so excited! Look at all the stuff we have." And my attitude is, "We're fucked. We have nothing." That's how we go into the idea generation.
Everything, really.
Into everything. That's right.
So what do you have at this point? A bunch of ideas.
Well, the hot fresh thing is I have a.
It's out there, so you got it.
Yes, you have to. I think there's two ways that you can come at a season premiere. And the ideal way is to get both things. You can come in hot or you can come in fresh.
I wish you guys could fresh. See this because okay. It's also his face sells it.
Right, and there's a lot of gestures. Coming in hot is like if, using ourselves as an example, last year we ended on a very dramatic note and there was a shoe to drop. You know, there was, if you saw, I don't want to, whatever, if you haven't seen the show, there was a dramatic family rift and coming in hot would have been dealing with that right away because people who watched last season went,
Five minutes later.
Let me see what happened. Yeah. We're at Victor's house and we're, you know. Coming in fresh is start over with something, you know, how we set the table. Mm-hmm. But of course, the thing with coming in hot is that once you do that, then what do you got to do? Then you take care of that. Then you got to start you got to rebuild the ship anyway.
Yeah.
But if you come in fresh, sometimes people are like, what the fuck? I'm interested in what happened. You know, why did they forget about what happened?
Right.
So you got to somehow do both.
So when you come in fresh, if you come in fresh, can you, the other thing doesn't go away.
Right.
So you can let it simmer.
Yes.
Maybe episode 2, 3.
Yes.
Yes. Which is what we kind of do.
Yes. Wow. Exactly. Exactly.
So I don't know what the hell you people are
talking about. What do you know about writing for television?
I thought they came in hot, fresh, and deep.
Wow. This took a turn.
I mean, and the family. Let's talk about those players. Oh. There's never been a family on the tube any more connected and collected and believably, I mean, you might bump into them after the show on the street or getting out of a car. They're a family. I mean, they live next door to you, or they certainly live in your head and heart.
I watched you guys shoot the pilot last year. And that was having done a few sitcoms in my day and understanding dynamics. That really struck me about not just the family, the whole cast. How it looked like you guys were in your third season then, but I mean fresh, like just had on the fun scale, you know, just on the comfort, you know, and it was really impressive.
No, that is they came together like they'd been together.
Yeah.
And I think there's also a huge appreciation when doing a Latino show like we're doing in a comedic setting. There's not that many Latino families in comedy, straight up comedy.
Right.
And so there's also this appreciation that our cast brings. They're so grateful to be doing things that have humor but also heart, and that it plays to all of their features. I mean, Justina Machado is as funny as she is brilliant at drama. Mm. Same with Rita, same with Isabella, same with Marcel. So they get to flex all of these muscles and show, they turn a joke in one scene and then the next scene you're weeping. And it's such a little, Justina said once, it's like a parfait for the actor. Mm. So it's that appreciation we feel, and they put their guts out there.
Right.
You overlooked
Todd Grinnell and Stephen Tobolowsky, who are also unbelievable.
Yeah. They are such brilliant performers. But the words you guys are, and meanings, and I was so in awe that second episode. Well, both episodes went so deep and different. I don't know how to explain the fact that, you know, it seemed to me after all the years I've been connected with the tube, let alone all the years I've just lived around it, there were layers upon layers that I hadn't heard before. And lived, didn't, you know, you live these things without realizing you have until somebody points it out to you. Oh, God, I was so amazed and proud and divorced from it. I mean, I came in and sat down and was overwhelmed as if I'd never known you guys.
Well, it's been a while since, I mean, you were there for the tape read, you were there for the taping, but it's been a while because,
right.
Of course, Netflix,
yeah.
You wait forever.
4 months.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
You know, it's been a while.
Tell the people listening the difference between, now you did Everybody Loves Raymond, and that was for a network. And you worked for a network, Gloria,
mm-hmm,
too.
I did.
So the difference between how you prepare for Netflix as opposed to a network.
I mean, it's definitely, it's a little more like a movie, I guess, because you get it all done and then wait till they
all
decide.
All is 13 episodes.
Right, all 13 episodes in our case. Yeah. And it's a little bit, you as opposed to the shows that you did where you could be a little bit more, hey, I read this in the paper today, let's do a show about it, and 6 weeks later, America's going to see it. We don't have that.
Yeah,
it's a blessing and a curse. You know, it keeps us a little less topical, but we what do we say? We like to be not relevant, but not necessarily topical.
That's right.
Is that something like that?
Right. And how clearly does this family represent your real family?
I think it's like a mix of Mike and I's family now. I've I think Justina and I have melded into Penelope. I think it's now the both of us. I've become very close with her, and so she. I noticed the way she says words, and you know, we talk as the characters in the writer's room, and once you get to know the actors, you can write better to them because you know their rhythms and their patterns. So it's fun to do that with all the characters, actually.
So you use the expression writer's room, and you know, the chances are there aren't three listeners who've been to a writer's room. Mm, and it's an interesting phrase, and what they're doing couldn't be more interesting. Describe a writer's room.
There are all kinds, but, you know, for a sitcom, it's a bunch of funny people who are also great writers who, I mean, normally we sit around and conversation leads to stories. It's not that we just sit and idly converse, although we do that too. But where this show comes from and where I've had, you know, the good fortune to work on shows that were worked like this is you're a lot of times telling personal stories, things that happen to you. And because there's no better way to get a sincere and realistic take on something than when it really happened to somebody. Mm-hmm. And for instance, that first show, that the first episode of this season deals with racism and colorism and a bunch of other stuff, but it's based on a couple of things that one thing that happened to Gloria and Justina.
And Justina.
Yes.
Then what was that?
Do you know this story? Oh, maybe you don't know this story. Justina and I went to Rita's 85th birthday party last year. She just turned 86 in December. So for her 85th, we went up to Berkeley, where she lives, and we stayed in this beautiful hotel. My parents were with us, and Tony Plana, who plays Berto, actually, on the show. And we were all having dinner the night before Rita's party at a restaurant and having a wonderful time. And it was a loud restaurant. And someone came to our table and said, "Excuse me, you are polluting the air."
But wait a minute. they saw One Day at a Time.
No.
That's what they were doing. They recognized you.
You're in the space-time continuum. You got the wrong way. Yeah.
No, but for everybody listening, this scene that Gloria just reflected on, it's having lived. She wrote, they wrote, and produced, and it was online. Yes. It was in the air. Yes. So what happened?
Well, we were sort of stunned because it's not like it was a quiet restaurant.
And went to your table.
To our
to
table.
To be clear, not
to
like,
our,
oh, this
no,
place
no.
is noisy.
Went
right.
To our table and said we were polluting the air and could we please keep it down?
Oh.
And then walked back over to their table and sat down. And we were all sort of stunned. And then Justina said, "Excuse me, I'll be right back." And she stood up and walked over and said, "Are you the owner of this establishment?" I mean, really, we almost verbatim did what we wrote on the show.
I love this.
And she said, "We have just as much of a right to be here as you." And
it's not a library.
This is not a library. We are not, you know, being disrespectful. This is a restaurant, and we are having a wonderful time. And was very classy and very together, you know, didn't yell or scream, was very poised, and then came back over to our table and sat down. And then Tony Plana had the great idea of, let's every few minutes just laugh really loud.
I love that.
So we kept talking, and then all of a sudden Tony would go, ha! And then all of us would start laughing really loud. And then we just kept on doing it, and it was glorious. It was just glorious.
And did other tables understand at all?
No one else cared. No one else knew what had happened, nor did they care, but boy, we really annoyed them. And finally,
oh, that's
they left.
Great.
How many people were at that other table that came over to
Two.
You? Two. Oh, just a couple.
Yes.
Two people?
Two people.
Yeah.
Two women.
And to us, it was great because we wanted to do a show about you can't – well, part of what we wanted to do was you can't let the assholes get to you. You can't live your life in anger. And, you know, this is something that people of color have to go through a lot more. Obviously, you have to go through that white people don't have to go through. So at the same time, you're teaching your son that – you know, this experience happened to Justina. And really the lesson is, well, sometimes you can't get mad. You know, if you get mad, they win. And if you don't get mad, they win too. And there's just, you know, things are messy. And it fit perfectly with being able to tell her son one thing and then really kind of 180 flipping it and in a way teaching another lesson, but also sort of, you know, going against the thing she just said to her son and how life is messy like that.
Great. Oh,
so interesting. Now, you use the word, the expression, assholes.
Yeah.
And we have a bunch of people listening who I want to – let's think a bit. You would have said that in your home with your kids, wouldn't you? You would use the word.
I would now. They're old. I mean, old enough. You know.
I still don't swear in front of my parents.
You don't?
No.
because of, you know, how they would react. You mean?
Yeah, they will. I mean, I have. It's not the end of the world, but I try not to.
But so far, right, we're at a moment right now where the audience is waiting to hear if you're calling them assholes. So you could just finish that thought.
No. No, I'm just wondering about, I hear it, it doesn't trouble me at all. I try to remember whether I might have said something. I think I talked frankly in front of my kids when they were, I wouldn't know what old enough is now.
Right.
But I think it's good to use the language that's used. I mean, the language we speak in the...
In front of the kids.
In the parking lot and in the schoolyard. And, you know, it's the language of our people.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's always context to it. You know, my kids know other people get upset when you say those words. So don't just go say those words without being aware of what you're doing.
I would say, like anything, it needs to be earned. You know,
yeah, right.
Like I like that in comedy, you know, when you first start out as a stand-up, at least when I did it, Mike was really
a stand-up.
No, but
you're right.
I was a pretend stand-up.
Both Gloria and Mike, for those
I was not a real stand-up. Mike was a real stand-up. I was like a squat, sit, squat, I don't know, up.
I did do it a lot longer because I'm much older. Go ahead.
No, but they make you – at first, you're not allowed to swear. Like, that is the rule. You cannot go blue at all. Your sets have to be clean first.
The club decides.
Yeah, that's what they did for me. Like, you could – they felt like saying fuck, saying that was like a cheat to get to make the audience laugh.
Right.
So your sets had to be clean sets at first.
Yeah. I mean, I never had a rule like that, but it is true. It's true that it becomes a crutch. Louis, who I can talk about as a stand-up, but I know all the stuff happened. So it's a bad example, I guess. But he went through a period where he refused to swear because he was swearing too much. There's a lot of comics who are like that.
Right.
Who realize it's a crutch and they, you know, then realize later, okay, you know, targeted. I think she's right. Earning it is the key.
Yeah.
You know, if we ever – I mean, we haven't used any words on this show. Mm-mm. Maybe someday we will because it's Netflix and we're actually allowed to. But, you know, we had a swear word in the pilot that got a gigantic laugh. And it wasn't even, a big one.
What was the word?
Shit.
Jesus shit, remember?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
See, that's good use of language. I mean, these are words that are colors. They're on the palette, you know, but you're not going to paint the whole picture with them, which is what a lot of acts will do. I have a friend who is a stand-up comic, and he stopped after a while because did you know a guy named Evan Davis?
Hmm.
Evan Davis is a great, great comic, and he never worked blue. It's just a point of pride for him. He wanted to work out smart things, you know, targeted things, as you were saying, and he was great. And he got so fed up with having to follow somebody doing 20 minutes of dick jokes or just like stupid.
Yeah,
it's just like,
right.
I can't fucking do this anymore, he said with the F word.
Yeah.
I just can't do it anymore. I'm done, you know? And so I get what you mean. But I think it's in the arsenal and well placed. Like that's one in the whole episode.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Because of that, you can use it and use it well. I think it's great. I think the same thing what you're saying about using language in life like that or in front of kids. Kids should know that these words can be used. Well, we don't say them until a certain point,
right.
But, you know.
Yeah. Mike, how did you make the transition from stand-up to writing?
I was In New York, there were a couple different ways. One was I got the Sklar brothers, who are also have a podcast and many other things going on. Had a show on MTV. That was my first writing, quote unquote, writing job.
What was the show?
It was called Apartment 2F.
Okay.
And it was sort of a hybrid, weird sitcom stand-up thing. But that was – I had started to delve into, quote, alternative comedy as well as the clubs, and that was making me like comedy again because I was kind of getting burned out. And I was really atypical. I mean, I wore a suit jacket that was too big for me, and I did not roll up the sleeves.
You can find it on YouTube.
Did you do the whole comedy club circuit?
I did, but I was mostly in New York. I was fortunate enough that I got a lot of hosting jobs, which paid better, so I didn't have to go on the road that much. But I did, you know, I did tour a little bit.
Right.
But I stayed in New York most of the time. After Apartment 2F, I was much more interested in writing. And then, you know, Ray got Everybody Loves Raymond. He started to write a book. He wanted someone to help him with the book. That became me. Writing the book with him led to there was a job opening on the show, and they hired me. That's sort of the long story short of it, you know. But once I had that first, I don't know, taste of, you know, I was a film major and a writing minor, and I always thought I would be a writer because I never thought I'd have the balls, I guess, to get up on stage because I was scared of it. And then once I did that, I was off on this tangent for 10, 12 years and then came back to writing.
So was that a whole new thing, writing scripted stuff when you started with Ray? Was that your first writing?
On Raymond?
Yeah.
Yeah, Raymond was like my first network sitcom job. Wow. Yeah, I was very lucky.
Yeah, that's kind of that's a big way
very
to start.
Lucky. Yes.
Well, but when you started from the beginning, the first show.
I didn't start the first. No, I came on the fourth season.
Oh, so it was already a big success.
I came on. They were actually nominated for Emmys for the first time a month after I got there. I said, "You're welcome." It was for the season before, but nonetheless, clearly I'm the...
And that was with the great Patricia Heat, who was on the
dress. Yes, right. Yes.
Who I work with on The Middle.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. She's the best. Wonderful. Yeah. Great cast.
What do you do on The Middle?
I do a recurring character, Reverend Tim Tom, guitar-playing minister.
Which is I know, and you write a song for
me. I get to write the songs for the character.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. It's been really fun because now I get a little glimpse because you were asking about the writer's room. Let me tell you, guys, all writers here, from an actor's point of view, or at least this actor's point of view, what I see the writer's room as. This place where these really funny people that I see only every now and then, even though you know they're always there. It's this room where they never leave, and magic comes out. Because every week, there's another script of funny, you know, well-paced, tight, you know, comedy. And it's miraculous to me. And for the listeners, if you don't know, they do this every week, when maybe there's a week off or you get a little hiatus.
Depends
or something.
Depends on the week.
No, I mean, some are, but for the most part, to me, every one of those are miraculous gems. Now, granted, I'm just grateful to have a job, so I'm approaching it with that in mind. No, so you already get a head start. Yeah. No, but it's really true. I mean, the writer's room is it's just amazing. So I've gotten a little glimpse into just a little bit of what you do, working with our two the two people who created the show.
Helene and Heisler.
Eileen, and Deanne. Uh-huh. Yeah. Helene. And so Eileen Heisler will call me when they have the script pretty much done. Say, okay, here's what's happening with Reverend Tim Tom. Sue is thinking about getting a tattoo. So Reverend Tim Tom will be singing a song about maybe teens shouldn't get a tattoo and maybe should have something about like the ink running by the time you're, you know. And so I then, and sometimes there's one song, sometimes there's two. On a great week, there's three. The last episode was five.
Oh,
that was fantastic.
Cha-ching.
I make a little kitchen. The rent is going to get well paid. And so anyway, but I'll sit down and with these notes and write these songs. And so what I've learned in 9 seasons of doing this is front-loading the funny.
Right.
Which is what you guys have such a limited time. I didn't appreciate this the way that you have how many pages to a 22-minute thing on network, right?
So you have 22 lines.
And I have sometimes 4 lines. You got to get the funny in there. You got to get the situation. And it's a little microcosm of what you guys do every week. But it's been really fun. In other words, I'm ready to come to work. So if you need another writer. So that was my pitch.
Gloria, how did you get started?
I started as an actor, and I had gone.
And excuse me. And yes. how do you pronounce Colette?
Kellett. Kellett, like pellet.
Kellett.
Like you know what? Like my whole life they've said Calderon wrong, so I'm so delighted it's the Kellett.
Wait, how do you spell Kellett?
Kellett, K-E-L-L-E-T-T.
K-E-L-L-E-T-T. Kellett, yeah. That
yeah, Kellett. Kellett.
Yeah. And Calderon, though, that's
Calderon, kind of, Calderon, like, technically, but Calderon is the American. Yeah. It's not Caldrone or Caldroni. Or, so.
Like my friend, the great actor, Paul Calderon. You know Paul Calderon?
I don't know Paul Calderon. Wonderful actor. Oh. Maybe we're related.
You don't know him. He's related to you.
He's my brother.
No. So you were an actor.
So you were an actor.
I was an actor, and it was 12 years ago, and there were the only parts I could audition for. Or the only parts that I went out for were Gangbanger's Girlfriend and Gangbanger's Sister. And I was like, really? There's not like a teacher or social work? Nothing? No young lawyer? There was nothing. And I would go in, and I'm very fair, speaking of colorism, I'm a very fair Latina. And so people would say, you're not Latino enough. and I go, oh. They're like, yeah, you could be like Italian, so we need like really dark. So I would try to spray tan. I would try, and it just annoyed me. And I thought, well, you know what? If certainly other people must be having this issue, I can't be alone. I'm going to start writing parts for myself. And I started writing for myself, and I loved it. I did stand up for a little while, and I loved that. But I loved the stuff that happened between the jokes as well. And so I started writing monologues, and I put up a monologue show that was all women, because when I did stand up, it was incredibly sexist. So there would be maybe two women a night, and all the male stand-ups would come and stand in the back to see the women bomb, because there was this perception that women were not funny. Mm. And so I went out there, and I purposefully went at first. This Westwood Bruco was a thing at the time. That's where stand-ups would prep their material before going on the late-night shows. I decided to go up in front of, like, all the stand-ups. And I remember Chris Hardwick actually came up to me afterwards and was like, hey, you're funny. And I was like, oh, okay. You're the guy that I'm singled out. now he's obviously much, much bigger than that. But he was very, very kind to me. So I decided I would, after experiencing that, I thought, I'm going to do an all-female monologue show. And it's going to be women of different sizes, colors, and backgrounds. And they're all going to be funny. And so I wrote 15 monologues. And I cast it. And I put it up in a black box theater in Hollywood. And that's how I got my agent and my manager, everything, because people came. The first night I went to Hollywood to all of my favorite charities. So I went to the Lupus Organization, the LGBTQ Center. It wasn't Q back then. I went to the Cancer, American Cancer Society, American Heart Association, and I just gave them 10 free tickets. I said, for your volunteers, here's 10 free tickets for my opening night.
That's brilliant.
And then I gave the cast free tickets just for opening night. And then after that, we had a line around the block 20-plus a night to get in to see the show. And we were reviewed, and that's kind of how everything happened. And as an actor, I never get nervous as an actor. But as a writer, I got so nervous. And I thought, oh, this feeling is exciting. And I just, the writing, everyone would say, you're a good actor, but who wrote that? And so I just started riding the horse in that direction because it seemed like that's where it was going. And
where did you get that idea to go to those charities?
Because I didn't know how I was going to fill the seats.
Yeah, but that's brilliant. I've been in that situation. I never thought of that. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I was like, well, this is a good thing. It's good for them because these people don't get to go see theater.
Right.
It's close because a lot of things are L.A. Nobody. And we would, you know, I was poor. I was poor, too. So it was a Wednesday night.
Yeah.
I'm like, who's going to come to Santa Monica Boulevard? That's where the Hudson Theater is. On a Wednesday night at 8 o'clock to see a show. I got to like give tickets away. And that's what we would do. And it would be, I remember I found out that LA Weekly would not review a show unless it was a 6 week run. So I did every Wednesday for 6 weeks.
Wow.
And we got reviewed. And I mean, and that's really what started everything. And I loved the writing so much. And at the time I was working for Cameron Crowe, who is a alum of my high school. And that was a very fortuitous job that I was fortunate enough to have when I came back from grad school. And he was like, you know, your writing, it's like you should maybe look into sitcoms. Because I was thinking maybe movies or maybe I wasn't sure what to do with this play.
Was he helping you with your writing? Was he giving you notes or anything?
No, he didn't have time for any of that. I mean, I remember one time John Cusack called him to read a script and he didn't have time. I'm like, if he's not reading John Cusack's script, he's not reading my script. So I didn't ever want to bother him in that way. He was so kind and so generous to me, though.
What a good guy, yeah.
And he was like, you know, think about, you know, maybe writing a spec. And I said, what's a spec? Because I didn't know anything. And so I started going to the Museum of TV and Radio, which is now the Paley Center, which now we've gone to, and it's such a full circle moment for me. And I would go and I would watch all the old sitcoms, Norman stuff, Charlie's Angels, Wonder Years, My So-Called Life. I spent hours in there just breaking them down and kind of taught myself how to write
That's
a script.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it speaks to, like, I didn't go to film school. I didn't, but I'm a playwright that's sort of a self-taught TV writer. And then with this, and then I wrote a sample Sex and the City script, and luckily I had that so that when people came and saw the plays, I was able to kind of hand it to them. And
wow!
Then it all took off from there.
How many people ask like, how did you get into show business? And you don't have the answer. Well, if you're listening, that's how you do it. You work your ass off and you figure stuff out.
But you don't tell her story.
I would just do that
story. That's Gloria Calderon Kellett's story.
Yay!
I said it right.
Yeah, but if you need a role model and a, you know, that's there you go right there.
It's hustle, man. It's
yeah,
hustle.
Man, that's amazing. And you know what else is great is that John Cusack's going to learn that Cameron didn't read that
when you rolled over.
So Johnny, I can feel
maybe
Johnny.
Maybe he read it after John. I don't know. Just at
they
the time,
are,
he was very busy.
Paul Hipp and Cusack are very close.
He's a good friend of mine, so he'll be listening.
At that time, he couldn't do
it. Hey, Johnny,
you
got to, you know, listen to the
Vanilla
podcast
Sky.
Today. I went to see Peter Gabriel with John and Cameron, and it was so funny because they have that iconic movie, you know, where he's got the radio over his head, and Cameron directed that moment. John played it, and there we are, and Peter wanted John to come out with the radio and hold it up over his head and hand him the radio. And John was very diplomatic. He didn't really want, he wanted to hand it to him. So what he said, why don't I hand it to Cameron and he can hold it up. But it was kind of an interesting moment to be there for that.
That's crazy.
Totally cool.
And
yes.
For me, Peter Gabriel, Peter Gabriel.
Incredible. Yeah.
Do you know, when I was 16, I jumped on stage with him at the Tower Theater in Philadelphia and he sang DIY with me.
Oh,
anyway, but
God.
Back to the interview. Enough about me.
But the two of you could spend a day talking about Cusack.
There we go. I never got to meet him. I just talked on the phone once.
No, he's a great guy. He'll laugh about that. Maybe. I don't know. I'll text you later.
Okay, let me know.
Maybe tell him how you happen to know John.
Well, we did a movie together. A Clint Eastwood movie called Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
Yeah.
And I auditioned. And at the time, this was 1872, mm-hmm. back in the day, mm-hmm. before video. No, this was 1998 or something. And Clint wasn't there. It was, you know, it was the casting director and a video camera. And I remember thinking, oh, fuck, nobody gets hired off a video. It just doesn't happen. Well, little did I know, Clint doesn't see anybody. And so I got the gig. And so then I go down to Savannah, Georgia. I haven't met anyone. I haven't met Clint yet, you know. And the first night there, we go, there's a local bar where everybody goes and hangs out, the crew, you know, just a local dive shot in a beer joint. And Johnny and I hit it off like we'd gone to, you know, those friends you had in high school that you just have a shorthand with? It was like that. And we had a time, we were just going nuts. We were riffing, we were doing all kinds of, like, you know, a two-man show practically and stuff. And the next day, people were coming up to me. Now, I hadn't had a drink. I used to drink a lot, and I quit. People coming up to me going, oh, you must be hurting today, you know, giving the old drinking signal. And I said, and I went over to John. I told him, I said, turned out he hasn't had a drink in years either. We were only two sober people in the place. You know what I mean? But we had such a great time. So we've just been buddies ever since, you know, kind of traveling. John will get, he's so great because he shares his good fortune, you know, and his hard work, but his, you know, but it's like he's got a laminate pass to the universe.
Right.
And he just thinks like, hey, dude.
I like that expression, a laminate pass to the universe.
You know, hey, the laminate pass is going to take me over to Tokyo. You want to go? Yeah, let's go. We have, you know, he's just a good friend. He's a great guy.
Fantastic.
He's in Chicago now, though. He's living in Chicago. He's
back,
just all he does
theater?
Is
back doing theater?
No, I just think he's just kind of Yeah, got burned out here. He had a couple stalkers, and I think that kind freaked him out. You know, like what's that? But he loves Chicago, so he's back in Chicago. And I got to tell you, I told him, I go there, we hang. You know, I'll go back for his birthday, hang out, go to some Cubs games. And I said, dude, you do realize the way that you're treated in this city, it's just ridiculous.
Right.
The Pope is not treated this way. You know, but anyway, he's a good dude. He's going to be on the show. He's going to come on the podcast one of these days. When
why don't we have him?
I don't know. Hey, John.
Let's do it. You've got a cell phone? Call him.
Let's call him right now.
Let's call him right now.
All right.
Yeah. So Paul is, he took out his cell phone. He's looking through his contacts.
Of stars.
of stars.
Look, Norman Lear. I have Norman Lear in here.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. I have Norman Lear.
You want to block that one.
Eileen,
do you remember the name of the script that?
I don't. I just remember. I got to talk to so many cool people working for Cameron though, because they would call to speak to him, and he was just busy doing. He is so devoted when he is in the middle of a film. He was writing a new one and also doing post on Vanilla Sky, and he just shackles himself up and just writes and writes and writes, and then does all the post. He was a lovely, lovely guy to work for.
Wow. And what did you do together? Which?
I was an assistant. I was like a second assistant. So I would get him his long neck Budweisers and Dungeness crab.
Mm. You hear that phone ringing?
I do.
My God. Just to think it's the phone of John Cusack.
This is it. This is the phone of John Cusack.
This is it. It's happening.
It might be the answering machine of John Cusack, though.
That's going to be interesting.
Trending that way.
Yeah, now we'll leave a message.
Sorry, the mailbox is full.
Oh.
It sounds just like him.
That's what happens when you're a big movie star. You don't have time to answer your messages, Mr. Movie Star.
Now, coincidentally, Jerry Prinzer and I had Embassy Pictures, and John Cusack's first picture was...
You gave everybody their first gig.
Of course.
No. God, what was the name
of
the first
The Sure thing?
The Sure Thing.
The Sure Thing.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Sure.
But every now and then, somebody's name will come up, and you'll say, you know, we gave him his first, like, from ER, I worked with. Maura Tierney. The great Maura Tierney gave her first gig.
Wow.
Eddie Cantor.
You want to hear an Eddie Cantor story?
Yes, please.
This is an Eddie Cantor story.
I can't believe you have an Eddie Cantor story.
I have an Eddie Cantor story. Oh, my God. How did it go? How did it begin?
Take a moment.
There
we
was
can
a
edit.
Confrontation on the street on 7th Avenue in the late 50s, 57th, 58th Street on 7th Avenue. Ed Simmons and I bump into him.
Eddie Cantor, wow.
And we have reason to say to him, I know we had a meeting. There was a possibility he might do the 4-star review, alternating with a couple of other, with Jack Haley, which was what we were involved with. And we had a meeting with him about...
The 4-star review being?
It was a television series revolving comics. And we had a meeting with him and we heard through some stranger that nothing was going to happen or whatever. In any event, we had occasion to say to him, Mr. Cantor, we were surprised not to have heard from you, or something like that, as kindly as we would put it to an Eddie Cantor. Mm-hmm. And his reaction was, he exploded. And he said, you stopped me on the street to tell me this. He said,
really?
you stopped Eddie Cantor. And he talked to himself in the third person. That way, you stopped Eddie Cantor on the street to tell him that. Just, I am shocked at you, man. Shocked. That was the whole.
And that was it?
Yeah. That was my Eddie Cantor experience.
That's a fantastic story. You know, that the other one that you have where somebody referred to themselves as themselves was, of course, the Mick. If you want to share that.
Mickey Rooney.
Do you know this one?
Yeah. No.
Oh, this is heaven.
Yeah, no, I was in New York. I had read, you know, a number of actors for Archie Bunker. It's before I came out here and it was in California that I ran into Carol O'Connor. And I had this crazy idea in New York, maybe Macaroni. So his agent, manager, was a fellow by the name of Red Duff. I knew him. And I called him. Red, I might have sent him the script earlier for any thoughts he might have had. I don't know. But he knew about the role. And I said, I just wondered if Mickey Rooney would be interested in a television. And he said, well, why don't you ask him? The Mick happens. No, he didn't say the Mick. Mickey happens to be right here. It was Mickey Rooney who talked of himself in the third person.
Okay.
And I said, look, I'm going to be there in a few days. Let me meet with him. It's a difficult role to explain. And Rooney, you know, I hadn't ever met Rooney. He grabbed the phone, I guess, from Red Duff, and he said, hey, Norm, you got an idea for the Mick? Let me hear it.
Norm.
And I said, Norm. And I said, Mickey, I will be there in a few days, and I have an office. I'm using some friend's office on Sunset Boulevard. Let's get to you got an idea for the Mick? Let me have it. So I said, well, it's a character, and he's bigoted. He's going to say he been spick and spade and this and that and the other thing. And he stopped me. He said, Norm. He said, Norm. They are going to kill you. They will kill you on the street. You want to do something with the Mick? Listen to this. Vietnam veteran, private eye.
Wow.
Short, large dog. Oh, no, what? Short, blind, large dog.
What?
Short, oh, blind, man. Large dog.
The Mick.
Oh, my gosh.
How did that never happen?
How did that show not happen?
Norm.
But I did do a show with him called A Year at the Top.
A Year at the Top, yeah.
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 It was on three times or something.
Wasn't somebody the devil in that one?
The Mick.
I don't remember. He was either the devil or he was one of the guys who were selling their soul.
Right, right.
To the devil for a year.
Wasn't Paul Schaefer in that?
Paul Schaefer was.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Paul Schaefer was, and yes. A guy.
Good night, young one. You can just go to sleep now.
And a guy. Who was the guy? Wolf was part of his name.
Mm. Wolfman Jack.
I don't know.
Yes. Wolfman Jack.
Oh. Hey, what do I win?
Hey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey. Yeah.
Vague memories.
With that, how long did that run? Was that on the air?
Maybe three shows, four shows. Yeah, I've got the shows.
That'd be good to revive that one.
It's a good idea, really.
Yeah, two musicians.
Yeah. God, well, I had that idea some weeks ago.
Yeah, when we ran into Keith Carradine.
With you and Keith Carradine. Yeah.
I wasn't just trying to remind you of that live on the air. So write in to Norman Lear, care of.
So about your show.
Okay.
Season two.
One day at a time.
So season two, so it'll be up as of midnight tonight. So by the time you listeners are listening, it is there ready for you. It is getting, it really truly is getting rave reviews. And I mean, the first season got raves. The stuff I'm seeing, because I follow Brent on Facebook, and so I see everything he puts up, which is, and you know, I mean, it's you couldn't ask for better. So congratulations, you guys.
And then you couldn't ask for better, and then suddenly the New York Times today is better. It's a really solid, glorious review. But when I say solid, I mean it's so thoughtful.
Yes, I really liked what she said, obviously, because it was very positive, but she was extremely... I feel like she gets where we're coming from. Yeah.
Well, you guys seem to have something. Your shows have always been character-driven and not afraid to find the funny in very tough and very dramatic situations. And you guys seem to be right in step.
He was pointing
with that.
At me with the first sentence. Now he's pointing Norman across
Lear,
the table.
The great Norman Lear. But, I mean, and so I find it interesting that you guys came together like this. How did that – is that something you've – well, obviously, you've been writing for your whole career came out of wanting to write comedy out of a pretty tough situation. So how did that all come about, that you guys kind of fell right into that zone.
Well, I do want to say that these reviews, in addition to being very gratifying, also help salve my great fear that when we started this, that the review would be Norman Lear's legacy came to a crashing end in a horrible, terrible misfire of a...
And you too.
Yes,
the people responsible.
Yeah.
So. Oh my God, I never thought of that pressure.
Yeah.
That's the second worst thing. The first worst thing is, but this went by in 4 minutes.
Really
me.
Did.
For sure. For sure.
This
yeah.
is great a time as we've had here.
Just great.
Yes. It was tremendous.
And who are you again?
Gloria Calderon. Kellett.
And Mike Royce.
Mike Royce. I'm trying to make you pronounce my name.
And this has been All of the Above with Norman Lear and Hip.
Yes.
H-I-P-P.
You guys are great. Thank you for coming by. Everybody watch the show.
Listen to this first, then watch the show.
Yes.
Yeah. There you go.
You can't miss. Goodbye.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Hip.
And life is good. And space and time. Give me some of yours. I'll give you some of mine.
Podcast One has new shows on our new app. Check out all the cool features to help you explore our exciting new programming, like America's Lakers podcast with Jay Moore, So Random with Corinne Olympios, Attack Each Day, The Harbaugh's podcast, Not Just Sports with Susie Schuster and Rich Eisen, and Sessions with Randy Jackson, as well as your old favorites like The Lady Gang, Steve Austin, Shaquille O'Neal, and Adam Carolla. Get the new Podcast One app in the App Store, Google Play, or podcastone.com.